Hi, welcome to the Artificial Intelligence, Machine Learning and Data Science Weekly Podcast. My name is Kwan Hong, or you can call me KH. In this show, I'll be talking to AI, ML and data science practitioners around the region. In each episode, I will dive into relevant and interesting AI, ML topics, where you get to know more about topics ranging from AI, ML adoption, best practices, and tips and tricks to be a better AI, ML data science practitioner.
Hi everyone, after a long hiatus, welcome to another episode of AI, ML and Data Talk podcast. In today's episode, I'm happy to have Dr. Vinod Ramachandran, who is the Head of Climate Risk Modeling and Credit Risk Innovation at CIMB Bank, as a guest for the show. Hi Vinod, welcome to the podcast.
Hi Kwan Hong, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I think we have known each other for a long time in through social media, but we actually have never met face-to-face before. And then we also interact a lot in especially in the Twitter space or now as known as X space. I see you are quite active there also.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I consider that my escape space, you know, rather because it gives me a lot more freedom of what I can talk about. And, you know, sometimes we talk about work, data science in general, but we don't always talk about work, right? I mean, as Malaysians, we are very involved in politics, obviously.
Yep.
What's going on in the country. And then I know there are a lot of good data scientists doing work on, you know, social work today that, you know, sometimes we want to comment on as well, but not in a professional capacity.
Okay. Yeah. So usually, as you know from my podcast, usually I will start with the self-introduction of the guest. Maybe you can talk about your childhood, your education, and then maybe later we can go into your career path. Like, what have you been doing that leads you to the current position?
Okay, sure. Well, childhood, I think, not so much of a different childhood for most people, I guess. So the average middle-class Malaysian family. I was born in a family with two younger brothers. I'm the eldest of three. We grew up moving around a bit because my dad had a job that required us to move. But, you know, mostly a couple of key schools. Government schools, of course, didn't go through the private route. When it came to university, I went through the government route as well. I did my Form 6 and then I started in UTM in Johor doing a degree in pure mathematics. Was not my first choice, actually. I wanted to do engineering, but my STPM results didn't allow for that. So I ended up doing maths, but it was a happy coincidence, I think. First couple of years was, you know, okay. I was not bad at math, but I was not extremely good either. And to be fair, I think one of my most hated subjects back then was actually statistics. I absolutely hated statistics, you know. I was always the kind of person that would rush their work, you see, and because I rush the work, you know, I always get last answer wrong or something. So working might be right up to 90% and then one miscalculation somewhere, you know, you screw up. So yeah, it was fairly okay. And then I think somewhere towards my fourth or fifth semester, when you start picking up the elective subjects, that's when I started to take more subjects towards the, you know, mathematical proof side. Rail analysis, abstract algebra, geometry. And then I found that, you know, those kind of subjects where there's not so much calculation, but the focus is on logic. I felt that I had a better connection to that, started doing more of that, and I was really good at that one. So by the time I finished my degree, I think in my final semester, basically my supervisor for my final year project said that, you know, if you're interested, you'll be a good candidate to continue a research degree. And, you know, thinking about it, I think back then, that was about 2008 or so, job market was not that fantastic. So obviously good opportunity for most people is, you know, if you can continue studying. And so that's what I did. So I got accepted into a PhD program, same university. And the work I started on was actually on epilepsy. So we had a project where we were modeling the brain waves of patients who had epilepsy. And what actually motivated me to get into that project was, so the supervisor actually showed me, you know, videos and interviews with people who have epilepsy. And this, you think about it, right? It's only what, less than 20 years ago, right? But in Malaysia, about 2008, 2009, there was no proper treatment for patients with epilepsy. Diagnosis is difficult to do because, I mean, it's easy to diagnose someone as epilepsy, but what kind of epilepsy was difficult to diagnose? And then a lot of the treatment facilities were available at psychiatric centers, right? So there was a stigma against epilepsy as well. You know, they think that, you know, have a mental condition when it's actually a physiological condition. So, you know, he showed me some of the work they've been doing. The project started, I think, in 1999. So there's been a lot of theory that they have done groundwork for, and they've actually split into multiple tracks. You know, they had one track focused on predicting when it would happen, one track focused on classification, like what kind of seizure you have, and the third track was on building out some of the theory for extension. So, you know, we spoke, and then I said, yeah, I'm interested. I'd start probably towards the end of the year, right? And then during the period while I was waiting to start my PhD, just do a bit of reading here and there. And there was another professor who offered me an opportunity to, you know, publish, do some research work under her and publish a paper. So I started with that first. So my first, I think, professional work was actually in abstract algebra, doing something called tensors, which today is being used, right? Quite openly in ML. So yeah, after that, when I started the project, I think there was a minor shift in the topic, mainly because my supervisor at that time had gone to Japan. And in Japan, he met this professor called Shunichi Amari, who was the founding father of information geometry. So information geometry, for those who are, you know, not familiar with it, is basically, it's a branch of differential geometry that analyzes the manifolds arising from information theory. So you have your probability distributions and all that, right? The idea is that theoretically they can lie on some sort of abstract manifold. And then you can use geometry to analyze how the manifold behaves. And thus you can, you know, some of the extension of how data is transferred along that process. So extensive applications back then that were being considered were like, you know, how the human brain works and stuff like that. So the idea to, you know, try and use that for predicting or classifying epilepsy was, you know, in my supervisor's mind, came back and said, let's try this. So, you know, I started that. Project, I think, started off well. But for me, as that time, I was a student coming from a degree straight into a PhD, I was not mature enough for the course at the time. So yeah, I didn't really spend too much of my time focused on my studies. Ended up extending because of it. I think it took me a good 6 years to finish my degree. Right? Yeah, but by the end of 6 years, we had some good results. Some of them published, some still left unpublished because I'm just, to be honest, too lazy to publish stuff. The kind of person who, I like to work on things, I like to see the results. But documenting them is always a pain to me. Yeah. And you know, it's really ironic that today the kind of work I'm in requires proper documentation, you know, end to end, and requires a lot of statistics, knowing that I hated it back then. Yeah.
Do you think this is karma?
maybe karma. I think karma would have hit much earlier because to be fair, my first job out of university was teaching, and the first courses I taught were all statistics. I retaught the courses that I sucked at, and then I even taught some of the more advanced ones. Yeah. But I get this life, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So you continue after your PhD with become a lecturer, academician?
Yes. So one good piece of advice my supervisor gave me back then was that don't come back here, right? He says that always go to somewhere else, see something different. So I did. I mean, I tried applying for a couple of universities. First job I got, I think, was at a local private university. So I started with that and then taught for a while. After about a couple of years of teaching, I realized that, you know, I don't have that much motivation to do research. And I want to be involved with something a bit more fast-paced. So around that time, I met up with a friend of mine, and this friend of mine, we're still a very good friend of mine till today. So he had actually worked for a while, right? And he's not from a technical field, but he had worked for a while. And after that, he had started up a company that was doing a little bit of tech work, including like data, video streaming and stuff like that. And he wanted to, you know, expand this company into what he called an ideation firm. So the goal with the company would be that, you know, you as someone have an idea, but you don't know how to execute. So you come to us, and basically we would have different experts who will be able to advise you and execute that plan, right? Build out the plan, if essentially like kind of flesh out the idea into a proper business model and then work on it. So he'd done a couple of projects for some small companies here and there, and then he started going into slightly bigger ones. And he saw there was a demand for some analytics work. And, you know, that's when he reached out to me and he said, like, would you be interested to come on board part-time? And I said, yeah. So I was doing this, I think, for a good 2-3 years while I was still at the university. And then continued on for about a year or so more, right? Until I think sometime about 2019 when I left. But during the years that I worked with him, I think that company gave me the most exposure to what professional data science is today, right? I was very happy to see that a lot of what I had studied and taught was being used, but the context, of course, was very different. So towards my last few years of teaching in university also, I think I changed the way I was teaching based on the professional consulting work I was doing. I realized that what I was teaching was too mechanical, too theory-based, right? And a lot of it just didn't make sense in the real world. Switching that made me a better teacher, I think, for that time period. And it is addictive when you start working on that kind of work, right? Especially in the sense that if it's a different field, different project, you're learning something new every day. And yeah, after doing that on the side for a couple of years, I told myself that, you know, I want to do this full time and I may come back to teaching some other day. So that's when I decided to leave academia. I moved to a boutique consultancy for about a year and still working at this company part-time. And I think close to a year, I think about that 10, 11 months down the road, that's when I got an offer to join a bank and moved into banking. So that period at the boutique consultancy, I think, was quite packed in the sense that we worked with many different industries, many small projects. But I think what I found very interesting about what they wanted to do as banks, right, is that the idea that today we have actually a very well fleshed out financial system, right, the market and everything, in terms of products that are available for both retail and corporate customers, quite a few things. But the idea that there are still a whole bunch of people who are still underbanked, no access to financial leverage. And over my time, I've realized that, you know, not having access to that leverage is something that, you know, can affect the lives of many.
So you're talking about this unbanked kind of people, isn't it? So there are people that actually do not have access to any financial institution. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, primarily that group. It's not just people, you know, as individuals, right? It can be companies as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually met, you know, customers who, for example, they want to start up with something as like a nasi lemak stall,
mm-hmm.
right? But let's say to start up the stall today, they need 1,000 ringgit, mm-hmm. which is not a big sum for a lot of people. But for some people, that's a large sum that they need to borrow from somewhere, you know. And if it's not going to be from a licensed institution, it's going to be from like an Along or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the idea I had, right, going into all of this. But then over that time, you realize that, you know, the reason that sometimes these loans are not taken up by FIs and all is mainly because the unit cost of economics doesn't make sense for them,
mm-hmm.
right? That's why you have like these new players in the market and everything going into micro lending and whatnot. Mm-hmm. There is a space for everyone, I believe, but to really understand how to build out the space, you have to also understand how the existing one works now. Right.
So I think in the context of the listener out there, there are challenges for banks, especially when they want to offer service to all these unbanked personnel, because they don't have any record transaction, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it's very difficult to assess their eligibility. So whenever you want to actually disperse any loan to them, there's also, because they don't have any transaction or historical data, it's very hard to assess whether they're eligible or the loan or not. Is that what the difficult, the problem that most banks are facing now for this or for these individuals?
Pretty much, yeah. So it comes from two perspectives, right? One is it's a chicken and egg problem. If you don't give people loans, you don't have any repayment history. And repayment history by far is the most predictive indicator, right, of whether you can pay or you can't pay. Which is why I think most banks today are moving towards using their savings information, right? But that requires people to put money in accounts, right? To receive salary in accounts and then spend from those accounts so you can see transactions. But for a lot of people, that doesn't happen either. I actually have seen cases where, because today, I mean, we're fairly competitive market, right? People have accounts with multiple banks. One bank might be for salary, another bank might be for your expenditure, so you only put a certain amount there, right? In the cases of like, if you're running a business which is a cash business, you may not even put the money in an account.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That means, like, for example, if you're selling Nasi Lemak, right, you're collecting everything in cash today.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is you keep that with you at your home. Some people bank it in, some don't.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no reason to for online spending or what, they might not bank in the full amount. Right.
So how does a bank for these people, are you using like a third party kind of indicator to assess these people?
I think most banks have explored third party indicators, you know, things like for repayment, it's like looking at utility bills.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of telcos have tried to work with banks right, over the years, utilizing their data as well. You know, they've reached out to banks, those kind of things. But fundamentally, you know, these information sources have limited usability at the end of the day. You're always going to have some niche section somewhere which, you know, doesn't utilize that.
Yep.
So, like, if you're on a prepaid card today, you don't have postpaid bills.
Yep.
Right? So, there's no repayment there. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these kind of things do happen. From bank to bank, it's going to be very different depending on their existing portfolio, right? Like, how their existing customers behave. Some have large deposits, but not very active. Right? So, it's a very niche problem in the sense that it's very specific to that bank's portfolio itself, which is part of the challenge and what makes this nice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can build the same model at two different banks or the same type of model for the same type of portfolio. And one may work and one may just not work.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to your background, so you quite interesting that that you said you are from 76 and you actually work as a lecturer. So I'm curious because you are like a data scientist. I'm sure that you know that data scientists, we need to do programming. We also need to learn other technology, for example, the cloud technology. So when do you pick up this all this skill set that's required for you to, you know, move to change from being a statistician academician to become a data scientist and at least to where you are now?
Okay, so I've actually always had a decent background in computing. Mainly because when I was younger, I think my first PC that my dad brought back was 486 Intel. It ran at like 25 megahertz and it had that silly button where you press and it goes up to 75, you know. When I was smaller, I wanted to be an engineer. I used to break everything apart. I would disassemble the whole PC, reassemble the thing. That's where I started learning. And then over time, you know, I used to read manuals. I think one of the first manuals I had was for MS-DOS. So started working on computers from there. I did a bit of programming when I was back in school. When I was in Form 6, I actually took computing as one of my subjects. Yeah, and did quite well for that. In university, mathematics degrees, they normally teach you programming. They usually start with C and then C++. But I had done both before, so the courses were not difficult. When I came to do my PhD, however, I think I had to branch out because of the time of data I was working with, the kind of problems I was working with. If the idea of you know, ready built packages and the repositories like we had today was not very solid back then, right? It really depends on the language you use. Like you had some you know, like packages like for C, C++, those kind of things. But if you're not from a computer science background, or if you're not really scouring the net for it, you probably won't know what to look for. So tried different, you know, different programming software because of it. I think I picked up MATLAB, Maple, for Algebra.
SPSS.
They even have one called Gap. Yeah. We didn't really use SPSS that much. I think I only started using SPSS when I was teaching in the university because it was a business course, you know, the business statistics. So they're using SPSS, yeah. And then I think for work, it was mainly SAS, right?
Yep.
For work, it was mainly SAS. And I think halfway through my course, there was a, you know, then this data science thing started to pick up, and they say that the new language is Python, it's R, that kind of thing. So I spent a bit of time looking into that, you know, picked up both, attended some courses, but I think a lot of it depends on you playing around, right? Like, if you meet people, you talk, you learn something new, and then sometimes that ends up being, you know, another thing that you learn. So we speak about Twitter or X, right? Yeah, I met people on Twitter, and a while back, I think sometime late last year, someone said, you know, I'm developing a course for Rust. Do you want to sit in and be my guinea pig? So I was like, yeah, sure. And then, you know, in a couple of months, you picked up some basic Rust, and then you play around with that.
I'm surprised that you still have time.
I think the only reason I did finish that is because I committed to it. You know, he said that if you're going to sit, it's going to be 12 weeks, and it's on weekends, okay. But yeah, I think I realize if I don't force myself to do something now, I'm probably not going to get around to do this.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, to say it's a big transition that you, I mean, from a consultant to working in a bank. So usually people say working in a bank is very dry, very boring. What keeps you, you know, motivated until that? I think you're already in the banking for quite some time already, isn't it?
Not that long, actually. I think what 4 years now or so. Time flew really fast. To be fair, your general comments are not exactly wrong. it can be quite dry. I think a lot of it depends on, you know, what you set out to achieve. So banking is hierarchical in nature, right? Very hierarchical, very rigid. And it's that way by design, right? Mainly for compliance and safety. It's to make sure users don't do things they're not supposed to do. And the whole system of banking is built on trust. So there's a reason that it's designed that way. But within that, there is still, I think, a lot of opportunity for innovation. So when I came in, I think in 2019, the goal was very simple. The bank had already been experimenting with machine learning. They want to further, you know, flesh out their ideas which they had on machine learning. And the focus for my scope was very narrow, which is only within risk management. That's it. And even within risk management, the priority would be credit risk, which is the underwriting or the lending part, right? Historically, the bank already had a data science team way before I joined. And I think they started the team maybe around 2012, 2013, something around that, right? And that team had been building all sorts of great things for the bank. They were doing the cross-selling, the pricing, the you name it, you know, like optimization. Where's the best place to put an ATM machine? What's the best amount to stock it at? All the kind of operational optimizations they were doing. But on the risk side, it was a bit different in the sense that because it's a regulated industry, the risk models are highly controlled. You have to present these models to a regulator. They have to examine it, approve it, and the models must be highly interpretable. That was the key thing, you know. So when I came on board, it was how can we build highly interpretable models that can be used for risk management purposes? That was the base question that we wanted to answer. And 4 years of work, we're still working on it. We've made great strides, great improvements. And we've seen a lot of value coming out from it, right? But it is still a long road. I mean, if you see a lot of material that's being posted today, even like the US is still talking about how these models are to be used. In Europe, they're still talking about how it's to be used. Singapore, which is, I think, years ahead of us, is still talking about, you know, like, we can use the models, but there are a lot of things that we want to consider, especially when it comes to fairness, transparency, and all that. And those are fair concerns, because the traditional models we build today for risk management, like usually the popular one is logistic regression, right? Very easy to understand, right? Very easy to explain. And it's also the fact that the users today are just so used to it. You know, someone who's approving a loan today, right, can tell you directly why a specific customer got or didn't get a loan, right? Down to that specific reason, they know. So that's the level of interpretation that we need to be able to hit with, you know, ML going forward. And that's what we've been trying to push for. Yeah.
So, yeah, so just kind of intrigued me, because I know that ML, explainable and now ML is very important. It's very crucial in banking. But then when you move a bit higher to the AI space, so AI space, you have a lot of problem in terms of explainability. So how much of AI that the bank can actually consume or this kind of technology? Is it something that most of the banking industry are looking? Of course, everyone wants to go into AI, but in terms of banking, because of this, like you said, the explainability is very important. So how much of interest of that banking would like to go into AI, but because of this factor that they need to be considered?
I think there's always interest. I won't be surprised if most banks have already started work on it. It always starts at the front end, right? Anything that is outside the regulatory space, you can start looking at that first. So knowledge graphs, improving customer service, right? Those kind of things, definitely they would have started working at already, right? But as you get more controls coming in, of course, the pace is going to be much slower. So, which is why if you ask me, like, do I keep up to date with things like LLMs and all that? Only at a high level, right? Do I work on it today? Or no, definitely not, right? I mean, do I see potential of using it in the future? Yeah, sure. There is a lot of information that's not necessarily tabular today, right? So this to be considered, I think going forward, that's an option, a tool for us, but that explainability is going to be the mountain to climb. Mm-hmm. Right? If you can't explain your tabular models, then that's a whole other ballgame. Yeah, so it's okay. At least I know that there's something to do for the next 10, 20 years.
There's always something to do, isn't it? Because technology is progressing very fast. But then how about all this? Because we know that banking is so highly regulated, there are a lot of, I know there are a lot of friends who are working in the banking industry. They have these issues that there are certain model training cannot be done in the general public cloud because of the regulation. So how much of control of all this? Because we know that to train any model, it requires a lot of highly computational power, which is, of course, the cloud can offer. But I think that most of the banks will have, especially banks in Malaysia, will have these issues.
So things have actually opened up in the last few years. I think there was always a misunderstanding in the sense that so banks are very traditional, right? Nobody wants to make the first move. A lot of people would prefer that one bank make the move first and then the next bank would, you know, say, okay, now it can be done. Our regulator is actually quite open in the sense that, like, there's a reason they're not prescriptive, basically. They operate from first principles, right? They give you an idea of what you can and you can't do. If you want to do something, you let them know and then they'll tell you whether they're comfortable or not comfortable with it. I think the only limitation or hard limitation has been data residency, right? Because you have PII data, right? Information that's personally identifiable. You don't want that going up into a cloud that's not within Malaysia, because it can be like credit scoring data and all that. But now we have data centers coming here, right? Now we also know that it's possible to build ML models without actually requiring any of this personally identifiable data, right? So that space has kind of opened up quite a bit. But I think most people start with on-prem first, right? And it's not that difficult to build clusters to model for these problems, you know, because like I give you the context of regulatory models, right? We spend a lot of effort on curating the data before we start trading on it. For us, it's not data set size that matters, it's data set quality. So I may start with, let's say, the portfolio of all customers within the bank, right? And then when you zoom down finally to what we want to build the model for, that data set is not that large. Right? It's still something that can be trained locally, but we have a cluster to do that. Yeah. So yeah, a lot of things goes into that.
So I think this is a common for any data science. There are a lot of people thinking that I can just, you know, put as much data as I want into the model so I can get a very good model, but they actually forgot that the quality of data is very important. So I think like what you have done, do a proper data pre-processing, then do a proper feature selection that narrow down the data size and also the quality of data that fit the model. We actually leads to a better prediction model. That's more important, actually.
We have a lot of operational constraints when it comes to the models, in the sense that I think we are not ready for, or the industry here is not ready for models that are refreshed very often, especially when it comes to credit risk, right? So traditional models last in production for years. You build them, right, for easily 2 years, 3 years. You monitor performance, is decent, you know? There's, of course, there's some degradation over time, right? But it takes years for the models to completely break down. So the challenge of machine learning, of course, is when you work with more dynamic variables, right? More sensitive variables, they tend to break down faster. So our goal starting was, how do we build a model that's kind of the best of both worlds? You know, you have to kind of balance that. And we found that we came up with new feature selection techniques. You can build a lot of features just by combination, right? Consider every single thing you can. Then we did that and realized that the problem you have is that now you have too many features. How do you cut down? So we regularly work with like 200,000 features, right? And then you want to cut them down into something that's usable.
Yep.
To make sure the model stays predictive over time, we need to do testing such that we always look at and we call it an out-of-time data set, which is basically a data set that's more recent, right? So if you want to allocate that, basically means you're building on slightly older data. And then there's a question of how much older data do you use, right? Because things change. The portfolio matures over time. Do I use 2 years worth, 5 years worth, 7 years worth, that kind of thing, right? So I think that's the part where it makes it not so mechanical, right? Because each model that you build for specific users are unique. And we realized that, especially COVID has been, I think, one of the major pains for most banks, mainly because the patterns of behavior have completely changed, right? And because of that, now, if you're building a model now, I would regard this as the most difficult time to build a model in the last 5 years.
Because the past 3 years of data is not reliable. It's kind of like an outliers.
Yeah, but you're in a fix because you cannot disregard the last few years.
Yes.
Right? And if you think about it from a logical perspective as well, the last few years is basically a downturn, a tough period, right? That's the best kind of data to put into these kind of models. But you need to know how to treat it. Like, do I discount it to a certain percentage or you know, some sort of treatment to apply? And that's what I think most people are trying to figure out now.
I just have one question regarding your title. What is climate risk modeling?
Okay,
how, because it's so confusing. How is it related to any climate? Because the climate is like weather.
It is pretty much, yeah. So climate risk is, so basically I started this position, I think in early this year. The goal is that to factor into account the impact of climate change on our customers. So you think about, let's say today you run a company, right? And your company works in palm oil, for example, right? With climate change, what happens to your product, right? Are you still able to farm as usual? Will that affect your yield? Will that affect your ability to run your business? And also today, a lot of loans are collateralized, right? Like for most people, if you buy a house, the collateral is your house on the loan. What happens if flooding affects the house, right? So these are the kind of things that we need to start taking into account. So there are basically two aspects of risk that you consider. The first is the physical risk itself. That means that for any assets that you have, how that gets impacted, be it flood, storm, rain, whatever, right, can be anything. Last year, we saw a lot of cases like people who are working in central KL, near KLCC, flooding, right? So that'll affect anybody who wants a car and drives to work, right? That kind of thing. And then it can also affect the businesses that are based there. Because if people can't travel to work, if you're the kind of company that requires people to be on site, like data centers, then that affects your ability to deliver your business as well. So there is a lot of complexity in that. And then the second portion that we look at is actually called transition risk. And transition risk is basically how sustainable is your company's business today if climate change becomes worse or more adverse than it is now. So some kind of businesses are more, you can think about it, they're more green than others, right? And a lot of business today will be incentivized to go green. So good example is like oil and gas, right? Today, oil and gas considered not a green sector. But over time, even big companies are moving towards alternative renewable energy sources, those kind of things. So the transition risk is in that process, how do you support those customers? Because usually transitioning from a brown company or a black company to a green one requires significant cost. That cost can be in terms of CapEx, it can be in terms of OpEx, and you know, where you're going to get the money to do all that from. So usually you will still have to rely on the financial system today, right? That means you might have to take out loans, you might have to, you know, upgrade your facilities, those kind of things. So the idea for behind climate risk modeling was to capture all those risks that are there, right? And, you know, kind of feed that back to the business so that they make informed decisions when it comes to dealing with customers.
So just very curious, how do you model climate risk? Are you collecting a lot of climate data? Are you looking at the changes in temperature or global warming or all these kind of data? Are you collecting all data to build your models?
So we are still in the infancy. I think when it comes to the models, we're keeping them quite simple as well, right? Different banks have different approaches. When it comes to data availability, right? So for publicly listed companies, I think a lot of data is readily available and more is becoming available as we continue, because slowly, you know, they're starting to enforce reporting standards. So in their annual reports, you know, they mention like what are their emissions, how they are investing in going green, blah, 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 those kind of things. For private companies, it's a bit more difficult to assess, because if you don't specifically ask, they don't tell you anything. So data collection obviously just starts now, right? But I think insurance companies have been collecting data for years. These are potential partners that everybody has to work with going forward. It's also an approach. I think the approach is at the moment not to try and predict what disasters happen, right? But rather to assume that there will be two options, right? Either acute, which is like suddenly something very big, or mild, moderate changes coming in slowly. And then try to factor that in the context of running a business. That means like it's more towards financial modeling, I would say, right? But you take into account the ability of a customer, you know, to transition, what kind of things that can affect their current collaterals. Yeah, I think that would be the more sensible approach to take. And it's also a bit of a, I think it's a mix, a hybrid approach, in the sense that if you want really good, accurate results today, it needs to be prediction for a short term. But the reality is that climate change is long term, right? And regulatory requirements, I think today, the regulators already put in you know, expectations that they want to see projections for different time periods. And some of it goes all the way up to 30 years. So a 30-year projection is, you know, if you don't keep things simple, then basically you're not going to be able to explain why you even get those results in 30 years.
So after starting at this position, are you more aware of the environment?
Actually, a little bit before. So I think my bank was one of the banks that signed up for some net zero targets and everything. And over the last couple of years, they've been running a regular sustainability, event. So the first time around, I think we were encouraged to attend their stuff. I attended, a couple of talks, and then, okay, I understand what's going on and everything. But when this opportunity to take the role came in, I thought it was something interesting to work on. But yeah, definitely a lot more aware now, because it is quite demanding in the sense that I think this will be a role that an economist should do very well at. There's a lot of knowledge that's required about, your macros, how they affect all these different things. And for me, this is the learning curve. Like, if it's the theoretical maths or theoretical stats, I'm quite comfortable with. But this is learning qualitative things, which is a lot of reading. Yeah. So that takes up most of my time now.
Okay. So since you're talking about reading, what are the books that you're reading now? Any exciting books that you're reading?
I honestly tell you, I don't read books anymore. I've not read books for years. I condense most of my information because I'm the kind of person who likes to read almost anything and everything as long as it's interesting. So I consolidate information on social media. So it's like Twitter, yes, LinkedIn, a couple of people that I follow and I read up on. I use Reddit a lot because you can just subscribe to top ML papers, those kind of things. And GitHub, yeah. So most of my information basically is crowdsourced. There are a couple of books where, it's specific because of some specific knowledge that I need to read upon.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, even those recommendations, like what kind of books I should read to learn that, right, I crowdsource as well.
Okay, you work smart.
You think about it, this is the greatest tool that we have today, right? The fact that you can ask a question anywhere and get responses from.
Yeah, now even with ChatGPT, you can ask ChatGPT to give you a summary.
I tried. I played around with ChatGPT for a bit. I find that I think I tried version 3 5.
Okay, 3.
Yeah, I tried version 3, I think. Quite fun to play around with. Very nice to see that, when you wanted to, if I had ChatGPT during my PhD, right, I could have saved so much time on my literature review. That's the only thing I think about. That it summarizes papers very well.
You can complete your PhD without extension. Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
So,
it would have been a lot easier.
So, any technology now you are very excited about?
LLMs, yes, definitely. I think it's going to change the way we learn as a whole. I always tell people that I thought of data science as self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense that you build tools and you build machines to automate and improve up to the point that the end goal is to replace yourself. Right? How soon
then you're worried. Then you're worried.
Yeah. How soon that happens, I don't know. I mean, we look at things. At a high level, people are very worried with AI and everything. But you play around with it, you realize that we're still very far from, sentience and that kind of thing. But I've always taken it as, if you don't use it today as a tool that augments what you do, and now we're seeing the pace is catching up, right? You'll fall very far behind. Definitely. I give you an example that I'm familiar with cloud, but I don't work on cloud often. So I think in that sense, I'm starting to fall behind a little bit on that, which is why now I'm putting a bit more time to kind of, brush up there. But the same thing would apply for these LLMs as well, right? These kind of models. Today, I'm spending a lot of time trying to work out how to build interpreter models for tabular data. But I cannot discount the fact that if generative models become intelligent enough to do that work for me, then basically I need to find something else to work on.
Okay. So I think we are coming to the, time passed very fast. So we're coming to the end of the podcast. So normally I'll ask a question to the guest. What are advice that you have for people who aspire to be a data scientist? You have gone through the different route. So, and then you probably also hire a lot of data scientists in your company. So what kind of advice that you have for people who want to be successful as a data scientist or AI engineer or machine learning engineer or anything related to data science?
I always tell people two things, right? The first one is that the scope of data science is wide, extremely wide. So there is room for, I think, a lot of people, depending on how technical you are on the applied side or the stat side, right? Or the comm side. That means that if you favor more the computer side, like building stuff, you're an engineer, you know, software engineer, that kind of thing. There's a lot of platform work. There's a lot of low-level work that can be done, which, you know, a lot of tech companies are focused on nowadays. At the other end of the scale, there is work which doesn't require you to have that good of a programming or tech background, right? Like my role today, my team, we prototype. We prototype a lot. So your ability to prototype is all that matters. You can't write production code, we don't care. Right? It's not a deal breaker for us. But your ability to really build creative models, understand where they're coming from, explain those models. So the statistical dependency is fine. So, and in between, you have your data analyst roles and all that, right? So yeah, there's a wide spectrum of roles that people can work on. But the second thing that I also tell people, I think, which is a very important one, because I see this question being asked very frequently, and I think it's the wrong question to ask. I'm from XYZ field. How do I move into data science, right? For me, I feel that's the wrong question. Why? Because if you want to move into a field, yes, you want to be the generalist at start, you can do a lot of things, right? But if you come from a specific field, you already have the domain knowledge, that background there. You augment that with data science today, right? And you're a specialist in that field. I think it's much more valuable than saying that, oh, I'm a data scientist and I can work on a multitude of projects. Yeah, but what field do you have an advantage over all the other candidates that are coming in? It's obviously the one that you've already been traditionally trained in, right? So like mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, there are a lot of high-value problems in those fields that can only be tackled by those engineers themselves, right? A third-party consultancy comes in, they're not going to be able to help you. And yeah, I think that too much focus is being given on, you know, the generic data science today, mainly because if you think about it, we where are most companies going to start? The low-hanging fruit, right? The easy problems, the ones that are easy to solve. But over time, when they realize the value of data science, they set up their own internal teams and all that, then the call for specialists comes in, right? Then there's the need to hire those specialists. And I think if you can set yourself in that kind of position, it makes you a lot more valuable.
Yeah, so basically you are saying that domain knowledge is more important if, because data science is kind of generic skill set, but if you have the domain knowledge, then you apply the data science skill set into that domain knowledge, then you are more valuable than compared to just a data scientist who have no domain knowledge because you just can do the basic like computer programming, you can do the basic statistics, but how do you apply that into a specific domain, solve
Yeah,
specific problem, that is more important actually.
that's exactly it. And if you think about it, right, almost every job now is slowly going to start becoming a data job, because why? We've started collecting data that previously we don't collect. Now, management goes for data training. They come back and they say even smaller decisions. They say that show me the data. I want to be informed, right? So yeah, everybody has to learn it now. Whether you learn it formally or informally is a different story, right? I know guys who have been doing data analysis work for years, but they've never done anything outside of Excel. But they are true masters at their work, you know, see what they can get done with that one tool alone, right? And then you realize that, hey, you may not need programming for everything.
True. Thanks for the advice. I think it's a great advice for our listeners out there. So I think that our time is up. Time passed very fast. Thank you for your time, Vinod. I think it's great chatting with you. I think with your interesting path that leads you to a current job now, I think there's something that most our listeners can consider also because there's not necessary you need to follow certain path to be a data scientist. You can actually be whatever that you want as long as you're interested in it and then be good at it. I think that's more important actually.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. Follow this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify podcast. If you have any comments or recommendations, I will be glad to receive your voice messages. Send me your voice messages via the link in the show notes. To catch all latest episodes, you can follow this show on our website, www.aimldatatalks.com, or our social media such as Instagram or Twitter with the handle at AIMLDataTalks. Thanks again. I will see you next time.